What if I told you the deadliest trap ever designed doesn't actually use spikes or poison or like hidden tripwires?
Right, no falling boulders or poison darts here.
Exactly. It doesn't drop a boulder on you or shoot darts out of a wall. Instead, it uses your own favorite memories, your deepest regrets, and, your specific personal insecurities to paralyze you.
Wow, yeah.
It essentially uses your own mind as the cage.
Welcome to this deep dive. Today, we are taking you on an exploration of, a really fascinating set of fantasy role-playing logs.
We really are. And we have our hands on three interconnected transcripts detailing a group of characters navigating this bizarre, magically constructed labyrinth.
Right.
The architecture of this space is entirely psychological, and our mission today is to dissect exactly how this illusion-based dungeon functions on a mechanical level.
Yeah, we're going to look at how different characters' mindsets completely alter their chances of survival.
Precisely, and most importantly, what you, the listener, can learn about breaking out of the mental mazes in your own life. Okay, let's unpack this. We start the logs with two characters getting dropped into this nightmare, Tristan and Sam.
Right, the knight and the minstrel.
Yeah. Tristan is a veteran knight. He's seen a lot of battle and he carries, a lot of emotional baggage.
Definitely.
And Sam is an older fey minstrel, basically a magical wandering musician. And their entrance into this trap is just incredibly disorienting.
Oh, totally jarring.
The logs describe them being nearly smothered in darkness, feeling like they are being, quote, devoured by pudding.
Such a visceral image.
Right. They get jerked along through the pitch black, hearing these jeering voices until they are finally dumped onto a hard stone floor.
And that sensory deprivation at the beginning is, it's actually a classic interrogation tactic.
Oh, really?
Yeah. By stripping away their visual and spatial awareness first, the trap essentially resets their baseline reality. It makes them vulnerable to whatever stimulus comes next.
And when the stimulus comes, man, it is intense.
Yeah.
So Sam uses this tiny bronze dragon figure to light a torch, and they realize they are standing in a maze of mirrors.
Just endless reflective glass.
Endless dark corridors made of reflective glass. And immediately the trap goes to work. But it doesn't target both of them equally. A disembodied voice starts taunting them, but it specifically zeroes in on Tristan's deepest psychological vulnerabilities.
What's fascinating here is the highly targeted nature of the acoustic assault.
Yeah, it knows exactly what to say.
It really does. The voice calls Tristan Little Knight and immediately goes for his specific fears. It tells him that his love, a girl named Hannah, is going to forget him.
Because she has far more impressive people in her life, right?
Exactly. Completely questions his worth and his identity. The trap is basically mapping his internal landscape and finding the load-bearing insecurities.
And Tristan just completely takes the bait.
He really does.
He tries to act tough, shouting back at the voice that he's fought the armies of the Destroyer, but the voice just flips that right back on him.
Right. He uses his own history against him.
It points out that Tristan actually served the Destroyer blindly for a time. It mocks him for hiding behind the excuse of, just following orders to avoid his own conscience.
The trap is literally reading his guilt and weaponizing it.
Yes. And the physical environment mirrors this. When Tristan looks into the glass, he doesn't see a valiant knight. He sees a distorted reflection of his inadequacy. In one mirror, he's the size of a child. In another, he has a belly and shaggy ears.
The underlying mechanism of the trap here is a closed-loop feedback system. It is specifically designed to make the victim defeat themselves.
Like an echo chamber.
Exactly like that. By reflecting Tristan's guilt, it generates anger and shame. Tristan then projects that anger outward by arguing with the voice and interacting with the mirrors.
Which just gives the trap more data.
Precisely. It gives the simulation more data to feed back into the loop. I mean, he even tries to draw a glass cutter on a mirror's reflection of his hand, and the trap mocks him by making it manifest in reality as a banana.
A banana. I couldn't believe that part.
Yeah. And then he draws mustaches on the mirrors to spite the illusion, and suddenly he and Sam physically grow silly mustaches.
Which brings me to an analogy I just couldn't shake while reading this.
Wow.
This mirror maze acts exactly like a modern social media algorithm. Think about how those platforms are engineered.
Oh, that's a really interesting point.
Right. An algorithm's primary directive is to keep you trapped in the app. And how does it do that? By feeding you the content that triggers your most intense emotional responses.
The outrage, the fear.
Exactly. It shows you the personal attacks, the outrage, the things that make you angry and defensive, specifically to keep you engaged. Tristan is arguing with the voice. He's drawing squiggles. He's getting furious.
He's reacting to every notification, yeah, basically.
Exactly. He is giving the algorithm the engagement it desperately needs to keep the simulation running.
That is a perfect parallel. The trap doesn't actually have to expend the energy to kill you if it can trick you into paralyzing yourself with your own emotional output.
Yeah.
Tristan is powering the engine of his own torture.
But the wild thing is, the trap completely ignores Sam.
It really does.
Tristan asks Sam if he's hearing these brutal insults about his singing voice, and Sam is just like completely unbothered. He says he didn't hear a thing.
Not a peep.
In fact, when Sam looks in the mirror, the trap doesn't show him existential dread. It shows him a fox-tailed beer waitress wiping up ale. And Sam just chuckles. Why doesn't the trap attack him?
Well, simply put, Sam starves the algorithm.
He doesn't engage.
Right. He doesn't provide the emotional friction required to start the feedback loop. When the trap tries to provoke him, his reaction is just detached amusement.
Yeah, he notes that the trap seems to acknowledge he still has a libido, and he completely brushes it off.
And more importantly, he starts singing a cheerful, upbeat tune, the Dark Dreary Dungeon Song.
Oh my gosh, yes.
In a four-part harmony style, completely a cappella.
I love that detail. He's just harmonizing with himself in the middle of a literal death trap.
It sounds frivolous, I know, but neurologically, it is a brilliant defense mechanism.
Really? How so?
Singing a complex four-part harmony forces the brain to engage its higher-order processing and creative centers. This actively suppresses the amygdala,
which is the fear center of the brain.
Exactly. Sam's use of humor and structured detachment acts as an impenetrable cognitive shield. He recognizes the trap for what it is, a practical joker trying to get a rise out of him.
Right.
By refusing to validate the illusion's premise, the magic simply cannot gain purchase on his mind.
So if the trap relies on feeding off a victim's act of fear and engagement, what happens if the trap encounters someone who simply doesn't respond to fear?
It has to completely pivot its strategy.
Exactly. And that brings us to a completely different character log happening at the exact same time. We have Hannah, the young fey girl that Tristan was so worried about, and her companion, a doglin named Rosie.
Now, to provide a bit of context from the logs, a doglin is essentially a loyal, terrier-like fantasy creature.
Very cute.
Very. And as a fey, Hannah operates with a slightly different connection to the magical world than a human would. Their capture is entirely different from Tristan's.
Yeah, totally different vibe.
They are snatched in a forest by an illusory version of Tristan. And this fake Tristan is subtly incorrect. He's unnaturally tall, his hands are too large, and he patronizes her, telling her she needs to wear a proper bustle.
He literally throws her over his shoulder like a sack of flour.
Yeah, it's not very knightly.
Not at all. And then the environment around them starts fast-forwarding. The woods blur past impossibly fast, manipulating time and space, until suddenly the wind stops. The weather calms.
And she's just deposited right outside her childhood bedroom.
Right, in a place called House November. She walks inside, and it is a perfectly curated nostalgia trap. She finds a bed shaped like a bird's nest filled with down and silks, exactly how she liked it as a child.
Everything is just right.
The bookshelves are made of living trees, stocked with all her favorite books. But wait a minute, I have to push back on the trap's design here.
Oh, why is that?
We just watched a death trap mentally torture Tristan with his darkest failures and regrets. Why would a malicious, lethal dungeon give its next prisoner a cozy bed, a quiet room, and their favorite books?
It feels backwards, right?
Yeah. That seems like a terrible way to eliminate an intruder.
On the surface, it definitely seems contradictory. But from a psychological warfare perspective, sedation is often significantly more effective than terror.
Sedation?
Yes. If you terrify a prisoner, you trigger their sympathetic nervous system. Their adrenaline pumps, their survival instincts flare up, and they will constantly look for a structural weakness to escape. They become hypervigilant.
They fight back.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. But if you provide them with absolute comfort, if you create an environment of sensory perfection that appeals to their deepest nostalgia, you remove the biological imperative to fight.
Wow.
You trick the brain into thinking the survival condition has been met. The trap tells you to just stay put, read a book, and rest. It is trying to induce cognitive complacency.
It wants her to go to sleep in that nest bed and simply never wake up.
It's the illusion of safety.
But the trap underestimates Hannah's power of observation. Because she doesn't just accept the comfort.
No, she doesn't.
She starts looking around the room, and she notices an anomaly, a full-length mirror on the wall. The logs note that she never cared about her appearance, so she knows for a fact she never had a full-length mirror in her childhood room.
And that single incongruity is all it takes to break the spell of sedation.
Just one little detail.
Hannah's critical thinking kicks in. She approaches the mirror and immediately spots the sensory mismatches.
Right.
The brain relies on congruent sensory input to validate reality. If you are in a comfortably warm room, the objects in that room should possess a relative temperature.
Makes sense.
But the mirror is radiating freezing cold. It's covered in frost. Furthermore, when she strikes the glass with her hands, the acoustic feedback is wrong.
It yields a dull thump.
Exactly. Acting exactly like solid wood or stone, not hollow glass.
Spotting those mismatches absolutely shatters the complacency. She wipes away the frost and she doesn't see her reflection. She sees a window into a winter wasteland.
A completely different environment.
And in that wasteland, she sees Sam trying to build a fire. She sees a ghostly, transparent girl. And she sees the real Tristan sitting motionless on his horse, completely frozen over in a layer of clear ice.
Just frozen solid.
Not breathing at all.
The trap's architecture is suddenly laid bare here. We can see that its boundaries are incredibly rigid, designed to isolate the victims in customized psychological silos.
Silos, yeah.
Tristan gets the funhouse of insecurities because he responds to conflict. Hannah gets the childhood sedation chamber because she requires pacification.
Yeah.
But a system like this is only as strong as the partitions separating those zones.
Which begs the question, what happens when someone physically breaches those partitions?
Well, it's explosive.
Because back in the mirror maze, Kristen has hit his breaking point. He stops drawing mustaches and takes out a literal flamethrower.
As one does.
He aims it at a mirror showing a vision of a frozen girl, and he just opens fire. The flames hit the glass, it cracks, it melts, and suddenly a blinding blizzard of snow blasts right out of the mirror and into his dark corridor.
It's a fantastic scene.
Wait, I need you to explain this to me. Tristan literally shoots a flamethrower at a magic mirror. But why does that cause a physical blizzard to blast back at him? I thought these were just mental illusions.
That's the brilliant part about how this magical system is constructed. He didn't just break a piece of reflective glass. He breached a containment zone.
Okay.
Think of the trap like a submarine deep underwater, compartmentalized into different pressurized rooms. Tristan is in one pressurized zone and the winter wasteland is in another.
Ah, okay.
When he melts that mirror, he is blowing a hole in the submarine's hull. The massive pressure differential causes the environment of one zone to violently flood into the other.
Oh, wow.
He forcefully collapses the isolated psychological spaces into one shared physical reality.
And the result is absolute chaos. Sam, who was just standing back singing his song, gets completely blown through the shattered mirror by the force of the blizzard.
Just coughs right through.
He goes flying through the portal and lands face first in this freezing winter wasteland. And here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
Sam's unshakable composure is put to the ultimate test. He lands in the snow, finds the real Tristan completely frozen solid, and then a ghost appears.
The ghost of a girl named Agatha Cunningham.
Right, and she's holding a silver sword, and she casually mentions to Sam that a compelling voice in her head is instructing her to kill him.
The stakes immediately shift here from abstract psychological taunting to an imminent physical threat. A literal murderous apparition is standing over him, and he is rapidly freezing to death in the snow.
And what does Sam do? Does he panic? Does he draw a weapon?
Nope.
No. He looks at the ghost and tells her that they need a fire to melt the ice on the outside and music to melt the ice on the inside.
Incredible.
He actually tries to teach this murderous ghost the chorus to a four-part harmony campfire song. He's staring down a silver blade, freezing in a blizzard, and he's telling an assassin, just feel the music down here in your chest, lass.
It borders on the absurd, but it highlights the absolute consistency of his character's survival strategy. He is still refusing to engage with the trap's intended narrative of fear.
Totally unbothered.
But the convergence of these isolated zones isn't over yet. Just as the ghost prepares to strike Sam, the ultimate unpredictable variable arrives.
Yes.
A massive night steed, a war horse, named Princess Peach Blossom Marigold Honeydew of February.
Peaches. We love peaches.
Peaches rushes out of the blizzard, grabs Sam by the collar of his coat with her teeth, and just bolts. She drags him across a frozen pond, heading straight for what looks like a frozen waterfall.
Now remember, Hannah, she is still standing in her cozy, fake childhood bedroom, looking through the frosty mirror. And through that glass, she sees this giant horse dragging Sam, charging directly at her. She grabs her doglin, Rosie, and dives out of the way just as the mirror absolutely explodes outward into the bedroom.
What an image.
Peaches and Sam surge through the glass, hooves crashing and gouging into the wooden floor of the bedroom. And as the shards of glass fly through the air, they don't behave like normal physics dictate.
Right, they dissolve into mist on impact.
Exactly. The illusion completely drops, leaving behind nothing but a solid stone wall.
This is the critical insight into defeating closed-loop systems. The trap relied entirely on controlled, curated experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Order, isolation, and predictability were its core operating requirements.
Okay.
The moment you introduce unpredictable, chaotic action, like a massive horse bursting through a dimensional barrier, the illusion's algorithm cannot compute the variable.
It just crashes.
Chaos is the ultimate kryptonite to a carefully curated mental algorithm. The processing power required to maintain the illusion fails, the simulation drops, and baseline reality reasserts itself.
The software crashes. Hannah is suddenly back in her normal travel clothes, and Rosie the doglin is full grown again. The boundaries are totally down.
The system has failed.
And because they've broken the system, they finally come face to face with the hardware. They meet the man behind the curtain.
Literally.
The door to Hannah's room is thrown open, and in walks a very solid-looking, very tired Fey Knight. But it's not a real knight, is it?
No. It is an air djinn.
An air djinn.
To understand the mechanics here, an air djinn is a bound elemental spirit.
Mm-hmm.
In the context of this trap, the djinn is essentially the system's central processing unit.
He's the server.
Exactly. He is bound to a glowing pendant around the knight's neck. He's surrounded by a maelstrom of wind, and he practically begs the group to just surrender and live out their days quietly as prisoners so he doesn't have to kill them.
He states he is just doing his bound duty for someone he calls the Mistress.
The Mistress, a powerful entity named Elysia.
And the fight that ensues to break this djinn's binding is a masterpiece of absurdity.
Oh, absolutely.
You have all this high-stakes tension, all the existential dread they've been fighting through, and how do they defeat the final boss?
It's so good.
The djinn raises his sword to strike Hannah, and Rosie the doglin runs right between his legs, yells, "For Lord Eon!" and aggressively bites the knight right on the chainmail underwear.
It is hilarious, but it perfectly illustrates how high-level sophisticated systems are often vulnerable to incredibly low-level primitive disruptions.
Like a dog bite.
Right. While the knight is desperately trying to dislodge the terrier attached to his hindquarters, his guard drops. Mm-hmm. Hannah fights through the howling winds, gets the tip of her rapier hooked under the glowing pendant, and uses her body weight to snap the chain.
The shockwave of the chain breaking is massive. It blows everyone back against the wall, but it works. It severs the connection and frees the djinn.
The system shuts down.
I just can't get over it. All this incredibly dark magic, the psychological warfare, the customized trauma simulators.
And it ends with a bite to the groin.
Right. Ultimately brought down by a dog biting a guy's chainmail underwear. It's like taking down a $1 billion supercomputer by tripping over the power cord.
Exactly. And once the system is down, the free djinn reveals the true backstory of this labyrinth, which completely reframes everything we just analyzed.
It changes everything.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the profound lesson of these logs emerges. The djinn explains that Elysia, the Mistress, built this incredibly elaborate, torturous, inescapable mental maze for one specific target.
The Lord Explorer Thomas.
Every challenge, every feeling of loneliness, every single dead end was meticulously crafted to break his specific psyche.
And did it work? Did she trap him?
Nope, no.
Because Thomas never even entered the maze. He never set foot in the door. He received the invitation to this elaborate dungeon, and he just mailed her a letter back that simply said, "Nice try."
Nice try. Just two words.
And the djinn notes that getting that two-word letter sent Elysia into a rage so intense it could have taken down a mountain.
It is the ultimate irony. The entire dungeon, all of this magical suffering, is nothing more than a monument to a petty, unrequited grudge.
That's wild.
Elysia spent unimaginable resources to exert control over someone who denied her. But Thomas understood a fundamental psychological truth. The ultimate way to defeat an enemy who builds a trap for you isn't to fight your way through it, proving how strong you are.
It's not about winning the game.
No, it is to refuse to play their game entirely.
And to add insult to injury, the djinn mentions that a goblin named Feasel just casually walked right through the entire trap completely unharmed.
Just strolled through.
simply because he happened to be wearing one of Alicia's pendants. The algorithm didn't recognize him as a target, so the trap ignored him.
Amazing.
The djinn then just walks over, opens a heavy silver banded door, letting the natural sunlight pour in, and points the heroes toward the icy mountains to follow the goblin.
It perfectly encapsulates the futility of the trap. Once you stop giving the illusion your energy, once you realize the system only has the power you grant it, the impenetrable mental prison literally just becomes a door you can walk right out of.
So, what does this all mean for us? Let's recap what we've unpacked here today. We've seen three distinct ways to handle a system designed to break your mind.
Three solid strategies.
First, we have Sam's method, cognitive shielding through humor and detachment. When the world tries to feed you your worst fears, you force your brain into a creative task. You sing a little song, and you refuse to engage with the premise.
Second, we have Hannah's method, breaking complacency through critical observation.
Looking for the clues.
When you find yourself in a situation that feels too comfortable, a situation that pacifies you into inaction, you look for the cracks in the facade. You look for the sensory mismatches, the frosty mirror in the warm room. Logic and observation break illusions.
And finally, we have Thomas's method, the unparalleled power of the nice try. And this is what I really want you, the listener, to consider in your own life.
It's a powerful tool.
It really is. Who is building mazes for you? How often do you step into traps built by critics, by societal expectations, or by toxic colleagues who know exactly what buttons to push to keep you running in mental circles?
Running the maze for them.
How much emotional energy do you spend fighting your way through an argument just to prove you can survive it when you could just mentally send a nice try letter, turn around, and walk away?
This brings up a vital psychological concept, the sunk cost fallacy. We often feel compelled to finish navigating a maze simply because we've already spent so much time inside it.
Oh, that's so true.
Practicing radical acceptance means acknowledging that the maze was designed to waste your time, and the most powerful move is to revoke your participation.
Just opt out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
However, I want to leave you with one final conceptual thought derived from the logs.
What's that?
While Hannah and Sam survived the psychological warfare and broke the algorithm, the djinn revealed a grim reality before they walked out that door.
The real Tristan.
Yes. The real Tristan is still trapped out there in the magical ice. The mistress crafted that specific freezing spell long ago, and the only thing that can rend its physical grip are the claws of a fearsome creature of ice.
Wow. So they broke the mental trap, they escaped the illusion, but the physical danger is still incredibly real.
This raises an important question about the nature of our own mental breakthroughs. Clearing your mind of illusions and refusing to play toxic games is an essential first step.
It gets you out of the maze.
Right. But realizing you are in a trap doesn't automatically fix the real world. The trap was merely a distraction. Once you achieve clarity, you still have to step out into the cold and do the actual, tangible hard work required to save the things you care about.
Escaping the mental maze just means you're finally ready to face the real monsters.
Exactly.
That is a heavy but vital thought to leave you with. Thank you so much for joining us on this Tustom Deep Dive. Until next time, keep questioning the mirrors, and remember, you don't have to play every game you're invited to.
Take care, everyone.